don't say anything. Ladies and gentlemen, isn't it nice to be called that and have it fit? Hadn't there been something? 12 steps to AA and 12 wonderful women, and it's only been the first session. There's a song that goes, it took a miracle to put the stars in place. It took a miracle to hang the world in space. But when he saved my soul, cleansed and made me whole, it took a miracle of love and grace. You are looking at a miracle. This world and this room is full of miracles. And the first time you forget it, you're in trouble. As he said, my name's Dr. Paul Flanagan. I'm a problem drinker. If I had been born earlier, they would have called me the village drunkard. But since that word got so sociologically unacceptable, they coined the word alcoholic for us, you see. And the word alcoholic become sociologically unacceptable. I've just lost my tunic here. So the word alcoholic becomes just as sociologically unacceptable. And now they call us problem drinkers. And if some of the movements afoot in this country take hold and bear a little fruit in a couple of years to come, we will be known as victims of Jelinek's disease. And that doesn't tell anybody anything. But as my sponsor once told a lady who, on being informed that her son was an alcoholic who burst into severe tears and sobs, he says, "Lady, I don't care what you call it, but when he drinks, he's peculiar as hell." Man walked up to his minister after a Sunday service and he said, "Reverend, I've got a problem." He says, "I come to church every Sunday morning and I listen to the music and I feel good on inside. The prayers make me feel good. And your message that I listen to, it makes me feel good. And I walk out of this church on Sunday morning feeling like I could lick the world." And then comes Monday. And you know, peculiarly enough, that same thing is true in AA. We go to an AA meeting, we get our spirits lifted, we get our directions oriented, and we walk out of an AA meeting feeling like we could lick the world, and then comes the next day. So if I can, in the time allotted, Clay said that I don't have a time limit, but since we don't have anchored catheters, I won't run into Jack's talk. If I could, I'd like to help you a little bit with Monday. I went to my first AA meeting, three quarters drunk, a full-blown agnostic. I was $54,000 in debt and I didn't know it. I had lost the right to manage money, to raise my kids as I see fit, to run my practice as I see fit. And I had about as much awareness of what my problem was as the inebriated drunk who sailed off the top of the Chrysler building and landed in the gutter by the doorman. And a large crowd gathered around this poor soul, and two kindly old ladies helped him up out of the gutter, and they brushed him off and said to him, "What happened?" And he looked around at the large crowd and says, "I don't know. I just got here." Or the lady who, after having two martinis, looked across the room at her husband and said, "George, don't drink anymore. Your face is getting blurry." As I stand here this morning, I'm no longer a drinking alcoholic. I'm no longer an agnostic. I'm no longer $54,000 in debt. I've regained the rights that I lost, and I do understand what my problem is. So someplace between that first meeting and this morning, obviously something's happened to me. And if I could share with you what happened to me, maybe it can happen to you. I found out in looking back over this thing that there are certain, for want of a better word, steps, but it doesn't refer to our 12 steps, that were necessary for me in order to get where I am today. The first one of these steps I like to call acceptance. There are certain things that I had to accept. At that first meeting, the man stood up there and bold-facedly said to me, "You have a disease." And I says, "How about that?" Here was this peon telling this doctor that he had a disease, and I didn't even know what he was talking about. And then he says, "You can never, ever drink again." And I said, "You go to hell." And he says, "If you want to make this program, there are 12 suggested steps you can follow." And I counted the ones I came down. There were 15. I could do those on my hands and knees. And I asked the man that brought me, I says, "What is he referring to?" So he picked up a piece of AA literature and he read the 12 steps to me. And all I could hear was God this and higher power that. And I knew I'd got hooked up with some kooky religious outfit that I didn't want any part of. Needless to say, I went away from my first meeting thoroughly discouraged. But here I am. The man says, "You've got a disease." Well, if I've got one, by George, I better find out what I got. And so I dragged out all my medical books and read what I could. I took all the free AA literature. I wasn't going to buy any. I dragged out anything I could read that had anything to do with alcoholism. And out of this, you obtain a mountain of facts, most of which to this day aren't connected. But you begin to get some idea what the problem is. I'm an alcoholic. Well, so what? You see, to an Irish drinker, that's like graduating cum laude. That doesn't say anything. But you see, I'm addicted to alcohol. Now, psychiatrists would have me believe that I'm an alcoholic because I was either breastfed or bottle-fed, whichever one he wasn't. That I came from a low economic group or a high economic group. That I was either an only child or the middle one at 12 or the last one at 23. That I either hated my mother or father, or I had anxiety neuroses or suicidal tendencies. You know, peculiarly enough, I have patients that fit every one of these categories. I have patients who have attempted suicide. I have patients who had to go to psychiatric unit for various psychiatric problems. I have patients who I know come from all economic groups because my account receivable drawer is getting bigger. And you know, I know they were either breastfed or bottle fed or they wouldn't be here. But one thing all my patients have in common, and that is that they're pregnant. And you know, they're not pregnant for any of those reasons. The very simple fact is that I am an alcoholic because I drank alcohol. I am addicted to alcohol. Now, if some of the work in Baylor and up in New York and over in Scotland bear some fruit, it may turn out that we're not really addicted to the alcohol per se, but we are addicted to a byproduct that comes from our drinking it. And there's no sense chemically going into this thing. But it is a wild addiction that's essentially the same as taking peyote, if you know what peyote is, that the Indians use. So chemically, we're not too far off. Now, I don't know of any alcoholic in this room, including myself, that ever drank alcohol by force. We choose to drink alcohol. I'm an alcoholic because I drank alcohol, and I drank alcohol because I chose to drink it. And therefore, I am responsible for everything that happens as a result of my drinking it and nobody else. And until the alcoholic accepts this degree of responsibility, he'll get absolutely no place with this thing. And unless the alcoholic is made aware of his responsibility, like they say, when you hide a man from his responsibilities, you fill the world with fools. Just look at those that are still drinking. Now, to get back to that dear doctor's touch of pregnancy this morning. I said all my ladies were pregnant. I don't care if they're 10 minutes pregnant, 6 months pregnant, 9 months pregnant. They're still pregnant, and one is just as pregnant as the other. Except that one shows a little more. You see. And for somebody to stand up and say, I am an alcoholic, but not quite as bad as he is ridiculous. And it's just as ridiculous to refer to an alcoholic as a young alcoholic and an old alcoholic. There is no such animal. It does a disservice to these youngsters. They're just as sick as we are. Now I'll get down off my soapbox. The man said I had a disease. How about that? What I found out, in like most alcoholics, after looking back at it, one of my big problems in coming to AA was that I was so busy analyzing how, when, why, and how come, that I didn't do anything. What I like to call analysis paralysis. You're so busy analyzing, you can become paralyzed and do absolutely nothing. And this is a growth program, remember. You know, even if you're on the right track, you'll get run over if you just sit there. So you have to do things. You have to accept some things and go from there. I can never, ever drink again as long as I live, safely. I will always be an alcoholic, either a dry alcoholic, a wet alcoholic, or a dead alcoholic, but I will be an alcoholic forevermore. Now, accepting these things is not enough. You have to have other things to go along with it. And one of the first things you have to have is what George Wiedemann calls a sincere and monumental desire to get well. And anything short of this is doomed to failure. And it irks my soul to watch spouses of alcoholics procrastinate with them and promote the alcoholism 5 to 10 years beyond where it ought to go on the basis that what they might do would seem unchristian or antisocial or what have you. If the alcoholic doesn't have this desire to get well, then it better, by George, be created for him somehow. If it hadn't been created for me, I would have never generated it, I'm sure. And most of you, if you look back over the thing, the more feet you get in your back, the faster you begin to move. To give you an example, if you'll visualize for me for a moment a garage sitting in an open field, and nobody's been using it. The weeds have grown up and the weather has beaten the sides. The paint peels off. You can't even find the driveway anymore, and it looks terrible. And so does an alcoholic. And the neighbors don't like this, so they insist on the landlords getting rid of this eyesore, which we become, remember. So he comes along, and with his hammer and his nails, he knocks the boards down one at a time, but he's Scotch, and he doesn't want to waste the boards, so he gets the thing leveled with the cement, and then he starts putting the boards back together. And after he's used up all the wood again, he goes across the street, and he takes a look at what he built, and lo and behold, he's got the biggest outhouse in the neighborhood. And the neighbors don't like that either, so he tears it all down again, one board at a time. Same hammer, same board, same nails. And he puts it all back together again. And when he gets across the street, lo and behold, he's built himself a small chapel. Now, by George, this garage can't become a chapel without something happening to the garage. The garage is incapable of transforming itself into anything. And neither is the alcoholic. Unless somebody does something, these people are going to die. Of course, we are convinced as alcoholics, if we stop drinking, we're going to die. So you have to add something besides desire, you see. You have to give the alcoholic some sort of hope. And when I went to an AA meeting, why should I have any more hope that this thing would work when everything else that I had tried had failed, you see. We tried to stop drinking before. Hell, I stopped 100 times in one day. We changed brands, we changed days, we changed combinations, we tried geography, you name it, and we've tried it and it all failed. And we walk into an AA meeting room and they say, this is the way to go. And why should we have any more hope that this will work than anything else we've tried? This hope has to be instilled in the newcomer, you see. And the first thing that instills it into them is a group of people sitting in a room just like you are right now, who professed to say that they were alcoholics. You couldn't prove it by looking at them, because they don't look like an alcoholic, you see. So either they're lying to me, or I have to take whatever they say as truth. And if they are no longer drinking alcoholics like I am, then there must be some other method of getting rid of this camel that I haven't tried yet. And if there is, then I want some of it. You're doing the biggest bit of 12-step work in the world just by sitting sober in an AA meeting that a newcomer walks into. It also proves another point. It proves that the individual walking in is no longer the Lone Ranger. I like to call it Lone Rangerism. Lord, when I walked down that step, I couldn't name another doctor that was stupid enough to become an alcoholic. I knew plenty of them that were hooked on drugs. That's usually the route that we go. But I couldn't name an alcoholic doctor. I thought I was an isolated individual, you see. But they cut that out from under me in a hurry. And then when I got dragged, not voluntarily, but dragged to this international doctor's meeting that she referred to this morning, which becomes a jury of your peers, you see. You're no longer just an alcoholic, you're a drunken doctor, you see. In a group of other drunken doctors, which consists of 650 of them. And I no longer have to suffer from Lone Rangerism, you see. Then one night, by coincidence, parentheses, you see, when we come to this program, the things that happened to us before we come to this program, we call coincidence. It's a coincidence when we stack our automobile against a telephone post that we just stick our head through the glass instead of the roof. You ever try putting your head through a metal roof? You miss it by an inch, you see. That's a coincidence. It's a coincidence when we sail out of the fourth floor of a Kansas City hotel and you get your foot caught in a drapery cord and you just dangle there. That's a coincidence, you see. It's a coincidence that we arrive at this program alive. By coincidence, parentheses, I got dragged to a Christmas Eve service, an agnostic such as I was. And during this service at approximately 11:30 on evidently some given signal, every light in that church went out. It got pitch black in that church, except for one candle that was sitting on the altar. And do you know how it didn't make any difference how black it got in that church? It couldn't put the candle out. It tried. It got pitch black in that church, and that candle wouldn't go out. And then the minister took a candle and lit it off the one that was on the altar, and he went down the aisle and they lit them, each one in each pew, and pretty soon that church looked like Monument Circle in Indianapolis at high noon. And it was midnight, all from that one little light. It doesn't make any difference how black it is when you come to this program. I don't care what your past looks like or how black it is. It ain't black enough to put this out. It'll work if you want it to. Then by coincidence, again, the very next meeting that I went to, a man got up and said when he came to AA, he had trouble with God stuff, as he chose to call it. And his sponsor said to him, if you have trouble with God stuff, then just spell it with two O's and be it. There isn't anybody in this room that can't be G-double-O-D if he wants to be. And you can be good, good, good to the point where you're almost godly. Just try it. But what the man was showing me was that I could take out of these 12 steps and substitute a word here and there so that the step fit me. We can't take thousands of people and pour them into the same mold. They don't fit. But I could substitute a word here and there so that I could hang on from step one long enough to get to step two, long enough to get to step three, and down the row of chairs we had here this morning. I've been criticized by people for saying that they can substitute words in the 12 steps. By the same people who boldfacedly substitute the word slip for failure. But I know full well that you substitute it any way you want to, that if you make this program, the steps will be right back the way they were originally written anyway. Now, by coincidence, at about the same time, I was reading a book, and the man in there was talking about a farmer who had a tremendous run of bad luck. One year after the other, his house burned down, his crops would fail, the hogs got cholera, he had more trouble than Job. And a man asked him, he says, how in the face of all this adversity do you have guts enough to even try to start again the next year? And he said, well, you see, I read the Bible, and in the Bible it says 150 times it came to pass. No place in that book does it ever say that it came to stay. And you know that's true. Because I remember a depression when we were lugging groceries around in a little wagon. And it's gone. I remember World War II. That was a fierce thing. Living in snot and muddy foxholes. And it's gone. I remember we had a Korean War. And it's gone. I remember we had great men in this country during my lifetime, and they're all gone. It came to pass. I don't care where you find yourself, it too will pass. Even the good. Good doesn't last forever either. It will pass wherever you find yourself. And then, by coincidence, at the next meeting, a man got up, such as I'm here, and he pointed his finger at me. You know how they do, they pointed at you. If I was in the Rose Bowl, he was pointing at me. And he says, do you know that you don't have to drink if you don't want to? How about that? I didn't know I had a choice. I was firmly convinced that if I stopped drinking, I would die. And he stood up there and said, I didn't have to drink if I didn't want to. I had the right to choose. So I hadn't lost all my rights yet, you see. Some sort of hope that this may be a little different. Desire and hope in themselves aren't enough. We have to add something else. Something we call faith. Well, boy, you mention the word faith to an agnostic like me, and all you see is two shoes going through the window. Because for some reason, when somebody mentions the word faith, they immediately put some religious connotation to the word. And that doesn't necessarily have to be true. Let's substitute a word. Call it confidence. Man says, I ain't got confidence in anything. He says, I don't have any confidence in myself or nothing. And I said, where were you at 6 o'clock? He says, I was home eating supper. And I said, then what did you do? He said, I got my car and came to the meeting. And I said, where did you intend to go when you left your house? He says, to this meeting. I said, you got here, didn't you? He was firmly convinced that when he left his house, he could get to the meeting. He had confidence enough in himself to get to a meeting. Which leads to a little statement, why so big, little man? You see, we always try to do things bushel size instead of pound size, you see. If you just take them little, little becomes big. One step at a time, you can build a bushel basket full. But just start little. I didn't have to accept this program on faith. I didn't have to have any faith. All I had to do is look. There was visual proof sitting right there in the audience that this program worked. I didn't have to have any faith in it at all. It worked. There it was. Complain because you can't go dragging alcoholics out of hotels. You can't do 12-step work, you see. You're doing it just sitting there. We come to this program with what we call fear and anxiety. Fear, you see. Fear is nothing more than a lack of faith, or vice versa, you see. Anxiety is some sort of apprehension over some sort of imagined happening. And in AA, we don't have any place for if game, you see. There's no place for the if game, so anxiety shouldn't be a problem. Now, fear is a little different. Fear is some concern over a real happening. But if we've got our feet grounded in this program, it doesn't make any difference what we run into. We're capable of handling it eventually. And if you find yourself with your legs shaking and your knees knocking in some situation, just kneel on them. Helps better than anything I know for the moment. The trouble with us when we come to this program, like the lady said this morning when she came to step four with this cotton picking inventory, which will drive you right out of your tree, you see. If you take it too early. Because you wind up, you see, with a whole list of red deficits and only a paltry number of assets on the blue pencil side. Which proves a point. I don't care who the individual is. No individual is a zero. I don't care how sick he is. He's not a zero. He's got something going for him. And it's these one or two little somethings that he has to rebuild on. You can't build a foundation unless you take two bricks first and put them together. And no human being is a zero. But we like to think we are when we are hit with this sheet that we have filled out. We think there's absolutely no hope for us. Except all the people in this room were in the same situation at one time. And they aren't zeros. They never were zeros. And nobody will be a zero. So don't downgrade yourself so far at the beginning. But you don't leap over this whole sheet in one day either, remember. Why so high, little man? One step at a time, one defect at a time, one day at a time. It's that simple. I didn't say it's easy, but it's that simple. I read an article in the paper, which I thought must have been written by an alcoholic. You know, anytime we read anything that sounds AA-ish, we automatically assume that it was a drunk that wrote it. Because nobody else writes that stuff. Unless we forget that, you know, that most of AA that we have stolen from someplace else. Like the 24-hour day program, you know. It sounds so great. Matthew 6:34. 2,000 years old, we swiped it. You see. So I read this thing in the paper, and the man says, I may not be somebody with a capital S, but I am me. I cannot do everything, but there are some things I can do. The things I can do, I ought to do. And the things I ought to do, by the grace of God, I will do. If you need a place to start in your comeback, that's the place to start. The things you ought to do. Desire, hope, and faith. Added to that, we need 100% honesty. And boy, what that'll do to your egomania shouldn't be printed, you see. Because we're the biggest egomaniacs on the face of the earth when we come to this program. And unless we get rid of this egomania, we won't make this program. And if we're fortunate enough to make this program and you let this egomania come back, you'll lose it. And that's predictable. Man was sitting at the table drinking, and he had drunk too much to the point where he gradually, during the course of the evening, slid off the chair and underneath the table. As some of us have. One of his friends decided to play a joke on him, so he taped a piece of Limburger cheese under this man's nose. And even unconscious, it didn't take him long to wake up. And he shot around the bar with a big, wild-eyed look on his face, you see. And he went outside, and he came back in, still blurry-eyed and shaking all over, and he went out the back door and came back in and stood bull-faced in the middle of the bar room and said, my God, the whole world stinks. But you see, it wasn't the whole world at all. It was right there. And that's where it belongs, you see. It isn't other people, it's right there. Sometimes when you're feeling important, and sometimes when your ego's in bloom, sometimes when you take it for granted that you're the best qualified in this room, sometimes when you think that you're going to leave an unfillable hole, just follow this little example and see what it does for your soul. Take a bucket and fill it with water. Put your arm in it clear up to the wrist. Pull it out, and the hole that's remaining is a measure of how you'll be missed. There is no such thing as an indispensable individual, you see. And to go one step further, there is no such thing as a perfect individual. I don't care what you do from this day. It makes people dive back into the jug after various intervals of sobriety. They figure all that they've done should have made them perfect, and it didn't, so the hell with it, and back they go. Not knowing that I don't care what they do, they won't be perfect. It's utterly impossible to be perfect. Because if you think you got there, there's something else you can do. So if you can accept what you are for that day, and so be it, this problem of parentheses, slips, failure will disappear. If you can accept what you've done honestly, there's no need to dive back in, you see. If you're honest with yourself. I can get back to social drinking. This is what they're thinking in the back here, you know. The only definition for social drinking that I will accept today is two people walking down the street, and one says, I'm going to get a drink, and the other says, so shall I. Because really, there is no such animal as social drinking. People drink as a substitute for something that's missing in here. If it wasn't missing in here, they wouldn't need it to begin with. And if you can put it in there in AA, you won't need it anymore. It's that simple. It's not easy, but it's simple. This program isn't complicated. It's the simplest program in the world, but it sure ain't easy. You have to become big enough to admit that you're wrong when you're wrong. Try that on your ego, man. You have to become big enough to say, I'm sorry. You have to become big enough to be willing to start over. And I don't know what it is, but for some reason, female alcoholics have trouble with this problem of starting over. They think that even after they've sobered up and have done everything they can, that they still have to drag all this trash with them the rest of their lives. And it isn't true. Like the lady said this morning, the good Lord told the sinner to get up and from that day sin no more, no matter what you did the day before, you see. And you've got just as much right to get up out of the chair that you're sitting in and do anything you want to do. You can become anything you want to become, no matter what yesterday was like. You have to be big enough that we becomes more important than I do. Like I tell ministers and priests, they ought to change the marriage vows from I do to we do. And half the problems in my office, it disappears. You have to become big enough that as what you think, that's exactly what you do. If that's what you believe, that's what you do. If you're going to be honest about it, you see. All I'm talking about is honesty. Day in and day out. Big enough to do what you believe is true. Nobody says that you have to do this all by yourself. You are entitled to get all the help you can get. In fact, the one that sits there and insists he can do it by himself is doomed to failure. We come to this program with our bodies racked from drugs, be it regular drugs or alcohol, which is a drug. We should do something to put our body back in shape. So you see any doctor you can get your hands on that's willing to help you. We come with our mental attitude all screwed up, and if it takes a psychiatrist or psychologist or sociologist, whatever it takes to straighten out your goofy thinking, get it done. Grab anybody that's willing to help. And we come to this program with what I like to call gangrene of the soul. And I don't know medically of anybody that survives with gangrene unless you amputate it. And there are plenty of men that deal with this type of thing. Ministers, priests, rabbis, you name them, you get a hold of them. They're willing to help. All you have to do is ask them. And you're entitled to it. That's another right that you haven't lost yet. You're entitled to get all the help you want to get. And then we come to AA, which is as good a source of help as I know. You see, because AA is like the Good Samaritan type parable, you see. In the Good Samaritan parable, it dramatizes three basic philosophies. The robbers that beat this poor soul and left him along the road operate on the principle of what's yours is mine and I'm going to take it. And the other fellow that came along and looked at this poor soul in the ditch and walked on and did nothing operates on the philosophy is what's mine is mine and I'm going to keep it. But the Good Samaritan and AA as a whole operates on the philosophy of what's mine is yours and you're welcome to it. They'll help you all you want. And then there is another source of help, which I found in this program. By coincidence, parentheses, I happened to pick up a book, and I was reading it, and it happened to be Vincent Peale's Power of Positive Thinking. And in this book, he was giving example after example of people who said that prayer worked for them to solve their problems. And I happened by also coincidence to pick up another book called Psycho-Cybernetics. And if you don't let the, if you just tear the cover off and forget the title, what Psycho-Cybernetics tells you is why it works. It's the same as Power of Positive Thinking, only it tells you why it works. But the man said that prayer power works. That if you prayed, you could have things. Things would be better. How about that? So I prayed like anybody else. I said, okay, I'll try it. And I prayed just like anybody else did. You give me this and I'll do this for you. You get me out of this and I'll do this and so on. How many times have you done that, you see? Deals. And you can't pray that way. I have found that the best way in the world to pray is to ask for absolutely nothing. All you are is thankful for what you have and ask for nothing. A man sitting next to me says, I can't be thankful for anything. I don't have anything to be thankful for. And I looked at him and he was a mess. And I told him, I said, well, you can start by being thankful that wrinkles aren't painful. That when you comb your hair, the hair on your comb isn't like having been to the dentist. You see, there's always something to be thankful for. And amazingly enough, by coincidence, the more you're thankful for, the more you get. And now don't ask me how come, because I don't know. And you're not going to get me in that box again, this how and where from and who did it. I don't care. In another book it said, do you know that on a given evening, at a given time, that Dean Martin could be in every living room in the United States from Minnesota to Texas and California to Maine simultaneously through the medium of television? How about that? And I got to thinking in my alcoholic, by God, if Dino can do it, somebody else ought to be able to do it, you see. Ain't that an egomaniac way of looking at it? But it's true. They tell me if I plug this microphone here into the circuit there that we'll get some sort of flow or something here, and this light will go on. If we plug the lamp in, turn the switch, the light goes on. I don't see anything, but there's the light. There isn't a person on the face of the earth at this day can tell me what gravity is. They can tell me what it does, but they can't tell me what it is. If you think that gravity doesn't exist, go out of that fourth floor Kansas City hotel and try to go up. Vincent Peale says you can latch on to this power that's loose in this universe simply with prayer. And I tried it, and it works. And as long as I don't get myself wrapped up into how, when, where, and from where, it works better. And the more I'm thankful for, the more I get, and I don't even know why I'm getting it. I don't even need it, and I'm getting it. Coincidence, you see. Then we come to this business of attending meetings, just like this, or like your local meeting. Like the people on the outside say, why do you have to go to all those meetings? Don't you get tired of all those meetings? Well, the first reason that I could think of right offhand would be that it becomes a sober association, you see. I never saw anybody quit drinking in a saloon. And if you're going to stop drinking, you better associate with people that aren't drinking. The Hebrew proverb says, if you set the table, the quarrel will cease. In other words, when there's food on the table, people are too busy eating to worry about arguing with each other. And if you can get these people to meetings where we can give them enough food in here to think about, maybe some of this argument that's going on in their head will stop. But you can't do that in one meeting. The Chinese proverb says, if you give a man a fish, he can eat for today. If you teach the man how to fish, he can eat every day of his life. And that's where people get kind of yacked off at AA, you see, because we don't give them fish. We teach them how to fish and let them fish for themselves. But we know full well that by teaching them, they'll be able to survive the rest of their life, whether we're there or not. But Billy Graham had as good an answer as anybody. He was finishing a crusade in Australia. And on the last day, when all these people walked up in front of that podium, they came up out of the stands by the thousands. And he was getting ready to leave, and the man that had organized it and had brought Billy to Australia walked up to him and said, this is the most amazing thing I ever saw. But he says, when you leave here, he says, do you think this will have a lasting effect on these people? And Billy Graham, just like that, says, how long does one bath last you? People want to know why you're going to go to the meeting, tell them you're going to go take a bath. Ask them how many times a week do they take a bath, you see. Because it's true, that's what meetings do for you. You can go to a meeting dog-tired, wish you'd stayed home, your head can ache, but you won't leave the meeting feeling that way. It's like a bath. And the more baths you have, the cleaner you are. It's a simple fact. And you can't learn it in one day. The more meetings you go to, the more you learn. If I had accepted what I heard at that first meeting, I'd be dead. It's that simple. You can't learn it in one day. And then you have to establish what I like to call balance in this program. People finally get their foothold in the program, and then they go off half-cocked, and boy, and full blast, AA, 100 miles an hour, you know? Like the lady in the grapevine said, I wish my husband would get drunk. All we have is AA for breakfast and AA for dinner and supper, and we go to AA movies, and we go to AA meetings, and we AA picnics, and if it isn't AA, we don't go. And she had AA right up to there, you see. And if you look at this life that you're leading, something like a cross standing up here, a cross in order to stand up has to be buried in something, and I like to think of it being buried in faith. And the deeper your faith, the more sturdy the cross is. And just label those arms business, home, and AA. And it's a physical fact that if one of those arms gets too long, the cross will fall over. What you're after is balance. Quality control, not quantity control. Quantity control. Quality control will keep you off of cloud nine, you see. Oh, that's a long way down without a parachute. One When you look at something, see what you're looking at. When you touch something, feel what you're touching. When you smell something, observe what it is. When you hear something, think about it. And when you're thinking about it, ponder over it a little. Try to understand what you're thinking. And when you talk, say something, you see. Life's clock is wound but one time, and no man has the power to tell just when the clock will stop at later early hour. To lose one's wealth is sad indeed, and to lose one's health is more, but to lose one's soul is such a loss that no man can restore. The present only is our own, and you live, love, toil with a will. You place no faith in tomorrow, for the clock may then be still. How much time do you have left to do what you have to do? You don't know, and I don't know, which is what I said to myself one night after I'd sloshed around in this program for a while. If I'm going to do it, I better, by George, get at it, because I don't know how much time I'm going to have left. Any more than the lady did 2 days ago when they came over to the place where she was working and brought her in off the line at 9 a.m. to tell her that the husband she had breakfast with at 7:30 a.m. was dead. It's that simple. How much time do you have left to do what you have to do? This is a grow program. You have to do things. Grow, you know. G for gratitude, R for responsibility, O for open-mindedness, and W for willingness. Willingness to go to any lengths, it says. And you don't go to any lengths sitting in one chair. The Spanish proverb says, you can have anything you want, says God. Anything at all. Just take it and pay for it. And it's true. You can have anything you want. You can become anything you want if you're willing to pay the price for it. Some of them run high. But remember, you're after quality control when you go out grabbing for these things. When you get what you want in your struggle for wealth and the world makes you king for a day, then go to the mirror and look at yourself and see what the glass has to say. You can cheat all you want through the pathway of years and get pats on the back as you pass. But your final reward will be heartache and tears if you've cheated the guy in the glass. Quality control is what you're after. And it takes good judgment for quality control. But good judgment, you see, comes from experience, which comes from bad judgment. So back to the person who is no longer perfect, you see. People make mistakes and dive into the drink, you see. But if the mistakes you make become the experience upon which to base your judgment the next time, the experience is worth it. You can't make judgment without experience, and most experience comes from bad judgment. So because you made a mistake, don't take it so hard. It'll pay dividends tomorrow or the next day. Step 12 that the lady said this morning, practice these principles in all our affairs. They told me I couldn't drink the second drink without drinking the first one. That's true. How about that? You don't even think about that when you come in here. But it's a physical fact that you can't drink the second drink till you've drunk the first one. Now, all your affairs, you can't tell the second lie till you've told the first one. You can't cheat your second customer till you've cheated the first one. You can't cut the second corner till you've cut the first one. You can't do anything the second time till you've done it the first time. And it boils down to a very simple fact of eliminating firsts. And life becomes very manageable. If you don't do it the first time, you can't do it the second time. It's that simple. I didn't say it's easy. It's that simple. Most people nowadays operate on this type of thing. If they do something good, they will shout it from the rooftops Look what I've done. Pat me on the back, give me a ticker tape parade. I want some kind of reward. And the Spanish proverb says they'll get it. They paid the price. They can have it. These same people who do something that isn't good, you don't hear them shout it from the rooftops. They kick it under the rug into Fibber McGee's closet, which is what he had, I'm sure. And lo and behold, you wind up down the road, you've been paid. All the rewards you had coming to you, and you wind up with a closet full of debts that you still owe, and which you will pay for. When life really is so simple, all you do is turn it around. If you do something that's good, you don't tell nobody. You just hide it under a bushel, so to speak. Don't let your left hand know what your right hand's doing. If you do something that isn't good, pay for it today. Tomorrow you won't owe the debt. And lo and behold, you get down the road a ways and you don't have any debts. All you've got left are rewards that you still have to collect for the good that you did. And you will get them. It's predictable, just like alcoholism is predictable. You do all the good you can, by all the means you can, to all the people you can, for as long as ever you can. That'll keep you too busy to even spit. But Edgar Guest put it better than I could. He said, the lectures that you give may be very fine and true, but I'd rather get my lessons by observing what you do. I might misunderstand the lofty words you give, but there's no misunderstanding how you act and how you live. And for that, you are responsible. May you all be in heaven a half an hour before the devil knows you're dead. Thank you.